Now Hurricane Matthew is moving up the coast from Florida and is expected to hit states like Georgia and the Carolinas as it continues traveling north. Currently, there are more than 800,000 people without power in Florida, and Governor Rick Scott has ordered mandatory evacuations in many parts of the state.
The storm has already left devastation in its wake in the Bahamas and in Haiti, where the death toll has been climbing over recent days, along with extensive property damage.
Joining us now to give us the latest on Hurricane Matthew is Jonathan Erdman. He is a senior meteorologist with weather.com, and he's been following hurricanes since 1998. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Jonathan, what is the latest as of right now with Hurricane Matthew?
Well, Veronica, the latest is Hurricane Matthew is only a Cat 2 right now, but it's still powerful. It's only about 40 miles to the east of Jacksonville Beach, Florida. It's moving toward the north. And it's just been raking the northeast Florida coast pretty much all day today with destructive winds, storm surge flooding, and also heavy rain. And all those impacts are now headed toward the Georgia coast and the Carolinas tonight and Saturday.
Did the eye of the hurricane ever make it over land? Did it make landfall, or is it just sort of grazing the coast there?
Well, that's been the fascinating thing about this, is because it hasn't made landfall, but it's been close enough where the western eyewall has just been scraping the coast. It started this morning when the eyewall started scraping the coast right at Cape Canaveral, and they actually had instruments that measured 100 to 105 mile per hour winds on U.S. Air Force towers at Cape Canaveral. Now, we haven't heard any reports of damage from that, but it's just been a fascinating case because it's just tracked just offshore. And it's just close enough, though, to produce the kind of impacts that we've seen in northeast Florida today.
What kind of factors determine what sort of path a hurricane will take? It is, at a certain point, it looked like it was going to hit Florida dead on, and then it kind of glanced off to the right a little bit. Do we have any way of predicting what the path will be?
Well, I'll be honest with you. This has been a vexing forecast for meteorologists from the start, you know, 9 days ago when it formed. Basically, the steering factors, if you can picture, there's usually a bubble of high pressure in the summertime called Bermuda Azores High. And it's called that because it generally spans from near Bermuda in the Atlantic Ocean out toward the Azores, a group of islands in the eastern Atlantic Ocean. And that's kind of usually the steering wheel for tropical cyclones. It generally steers them on the south side of it from east to west. And then it rounds the western side of that Bermuda High. And oftentimes, hurricanes will curl out to sea safely off the East Coast and not be a factor. But what's happened this time is that there's been high pressure in the upper atmosphere well west of Bermuda that has trapped this storm and pushed it much closer to the U.S. coast, unfortunately. And that means we've had this track right near Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. So a lot of it depends on just what the steering wheel is in the atmosphere. And this time, the steering wheel has basically steered Matthew right toward the coast.
Now, as you said, Matthew's a Category 2 now. It was a Category 4 not too long ago. Does this mean that the worst is over, or are we still looking for more devastation in the form of maybe that storm surge we keep hearing about?
Well, that's a good question, Veronica. You know, there's a misperception out there that it's all about the winds of a tropical storm or hurricane. And obviously there can be a lot of wind damage produced. If it's a Category 4, you could have major structural damage of homes. But what happens is the storm surge, which is typically the deadliest part of a hurricane, is generally a function of the size of the hurricane's wind field. So one example I like to use is Hurricane Ike hit the Texas coast in 2008. Well, Hurricane Ike was only a Category 2 when it made landfall, but it had a gigantic wind field. And what you need to generate waves and generate storm surge is a large wind field, you know, winds blowing over a large area of the ocean over a long distance and over a long period of time. And it just pushes that water up toward the coast in what's called the storm surge. So in Matthew's case, yes, it is only a Category 2 right now, but it's already generated this push of water, what we call the storm surge, and that's getting pushed now up toward the Georgia coast and the Carolinas this weekend. So it's really not a function as much of the intensity of the storm as it is the size of the storm.
And you mentioned Hurricane Ike from, you know, several years back, and I understand that it's been a while since the East Coast has taken a hit from a hurricane like this. Why has it been so long? Do we have any theories on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the biggest one, obviously, in recent times has been Sandy, which we talk about, you know, nomenclature and meteorology a lot. Officially, Sandy was not a hurricane when it made landfall. It was something called a post-tropical cyclone. But at any rate, it was a big storm with a lot of wind that devastated New Jersey. What's happened in recent years in the Atlantic Ocean is that we've had, a couple of negative factors on hurricanes and tropical storms when they form down in the Caribbean Sea or when they form between the Lesser Antilles and Africa. There have been two factors that have kind of beaten down those storms before they've had a chance to really get going. And one is dry air in the atmosphere. Generally, if you have air that's really dry, it tends to produce downdrafts or downward currents of air that disperse thunderstorms away from an area of low pressure. So it just doesn't allow a tropical storm to form and maintain itself. And then we've had a factor that's called wind shear. It's just a change in wind speed and or direction with height. And what wind shear does is it'll either rip apart hurricanes or tropical storms. It'll push all the thunderstorms away from the area of low pressure. So that is something that, beats down hurricanes and tropical storms too. So over the last 3 or 4 years, those two factors, either one or the other or both, have really worked to keep the hurricane threat away from the U.S. for the most part. So we've been lucky, but as usual, the luck eventually runs out.
We're speaking right now with Jonathan Erdman about Hurricane Matthew. He's a senior meteorologist for weather.com and has been covering hurricanes for nearly two decades.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear more about the progress of Hurricane Matthew and the science of hurricanes. And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have questions for our guest about hurricanes? Have you ever experienced one yourself? Share your stories and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about Hurricane Matthew and its progress along the eastern seaboard. We're taking your questions about hurricanes or your experiences if you've seen them firsthand. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking to senior meteorologist Jonathan Erdman. He works for weather.com and has been following hurricanes throughout his career. And Jonathan, President Obama declared a federal state of emergency ahead of the storm and spoke to reporters today. Here's what he had to say.
The potential for storm surge, flooding, loss of life, and severe property damage continues to exist. And people continue to need to follow the instructions of their local officials over the course of the next 24, 48, 72 hours.
And Jonathan, what do you make of the emergency alerts, the awareness for the public that came before the storm? Did it get the job done?
Well, that's a point of debate. We saw some cases where people were moving out. Obviously, we had, a lot of evacuations going on from Northeast Florida through the Carolinas. And that was good, but we also heard some cases of people that just refused to leave. And then today we saw other cases where people that refused to leave suddenly were requesting assistance because all of a sudden there was 2, 3, or 4 feet of storm surge right outside their front door. It is a problem. I think it's human nature. We don't respect the power of water as much as we respect the power of wind. We see a lot of specials on, say, National Geographic or Discovery Channel about tornadoes and all about wind, but it's the water that kills people when it comes to hurricanes and tropical storms. In fact, 88% of U.S. deaths over about a 30-year period were due to water, not wind, and the storm surge is the big problem. So that's what we're still struggling with, is how to get the message out to tell people, hey, there's going to be 6 feet of water outside your front door as from storm surge. And not only that, there's going to be battering waves atop that storm surge that not only could flood your house, but could smash it up. And honestly, we're getting the word out. Some people are leaving, but we're still, I think there's just still too many that just don't respect the power of the storm surge.
And there's still time for people to evacuate who are still in the path, right?
I would say there's still time in parts of the Carolinas. The time is really running out in the Georgia coast because, again, the center is right near the Florida-Georgia border, just off the coast there. So, I mean, we're already starting to see storm surge flooding in places like Charleston, South Carolina. We already had some homes that were undermined at the high tide midday today in Edisto Beach, South Carolina. So the time is really running out. So it's so important when people get evacuation orders that they do so quickly because waiting for the last minute, waiting until the water's already coming up could be too late. Your evacuation route could actually be flooded.
Let's take a caller, and we've got Fred joining us in Michigan. Fred, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I survived Hurricane Camille down in Gulfport, Mississippi in 1969. That was a Cat 5 storm, I believe, if I have the categories right. We were experiencing winds of upwards of 200 miles an hour.
Wow.
And that came in, I think it was around midnight, something like that, when it came in. But in the afternoon, I was on the four-lane highway, and we had water a foot deep already. I was stationed in Gulfport, Mississippi. I was attached to a naval construction battalion. And we spent several weeks after the hurricane cleaning up the city and the streets, trying to get everything passable again. And we shipped Agent Orange to Vietnam from that base, and so we had broken barrels of Agent Orange all over the place.
Wow, Fred, that's quite a story. Obviously still stayed with you these many years later. Do you remember anything about Camille, Jonathan?
Well, that's one of the ones that is forever burned in people's memory that either forecasted for it or lived through it. That was one of the only three Category 5 landfalls in U.S. history. And before Katrina, obviously Katrina, a lot of the attention went to New Orleans, but, you know, the biggest storm surge from Katrina was not in Louisiana. It was actually right along that same section of coast that Fred was talking about. So, I wasn't alive with Camille, but certainly any meteorologist that is into hurricanes puts Camille right on the Mount Rushmore of hurricanes that's hit the U.S. Fred, if I can ask, where were you? Were you right on the coast? Did you see a lot of storm surge?
We had a lot of surge. Our base, we were a little off the coast. We had a port on the ocean. Our base sustained extensive damage. We lost 85% of our barracks.
Wow. Yeah, again, quite a story there, Fred. I'm glad you called and shared it with us. And Matthew, just a couple seconds left, but how do you think Matthew is going to rate in that pantheon of East Coast hurricanes?
Well, I think it has a good chance. So hurricanes can get retired. Their names become notorious enough where they're just not used anymore. This has a chance more because of what it's done in Haiti and the devastation there. But we literally were miles away from having one of the costliest hurricanes in U.S. history because the center just stayed just far enough offshore. Now, the flooding could still be an issue, but we're going to have to see how that turns out in the Carolinas. Hopefully not too bad.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet.
That was Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist for weather.com, talking about Hurricane Matthew.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You may have seen our next guest TV show where he rescues unwanted or out-of-control dogs from animal shelters and brings them to his training facility to transform them into perfect pets.
Brandon McMillan joins us now. He's a celebrity animal trainer, star of the TV show Lucky Dog, and author of the book Lucky Dog Lessons, Train Your Dog in 7 Days. Brandon, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into dogs in particular, Brandon, you've worked with animals from cockroaches to tigers and everywhere in between. How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, my entire family were all wild animal trainers in the entertainment industry. So when I was born, basically, I had big animals surrounding my entire house. So it's funny you bring up the cockroach thing, because that was one of my one of my first jobs when I moved to Hollywood. It was a Nine Inch Nails video, and we had these Madagascar hissing cockroaches. They're about the size of your hand, and when you press on the back, they literally stand up like in the the 30 style boxing position and hit you.
I'm a Nine Inch Nails fan. Which video was that, so I can go back and watch your cockroaches in action?
It was called Closer.
Closer. Okay, right. I remember that one.
Yeah, well, very famous video.
I would talk to you more about that, but let's get into dogs now. That's what you've got this new book out about. And one lesson you kind of hit early on is there's not really a one-size-fits-all approach. We need to focus, when we're starting to train a dog, on a lot of specific things, breed, age, things like that. Can you talk about that a little?
Exactly. You know, there might be books out there that cover this, but I really, I haven't found them. I think a big point that needs to be made about dog training is the variables of the breeds out there, the variables of the age, the history of that particular dog. This all plays vital roles into the personality. And once we factor all these things, it's like a formula, it's like an equation. We sort of solve the equation. We say, okay, well, I have a German Shepherd. We know they're a herding breed. They have more high energy. They're built for work. I know the history of this dog. It was in the backyard. It was maybe abused. I know it's a little bit older, so he doesn't learn as fast. He can still learn. And so we take all these factors into play, and then this is how we begin a game plan. Without a game plan, you really can't train an animal. That's where I think a lot of people fall on their face with animal training, is they don't have a game plan. They all approach it the same way. They're like, oh, I got a dog. I'm going to teach it to lie down. Well, let's form a game plan, because there are no dogs in the world that are a fluke. They were all bred. They were all designed for something before we had technology,
And I wonder if a lot of people come in without a game plan at all. They wait until, they just go along and wait until, the dog's barking too much, or there's an aggression problem. They wait until there's a problem before they start training. Should that be a job one before we even get the dog, that we're thinking about a training plan?
Oh, absolutely. I say small problems turn into big problems, and that's exactly what happens. That's why I'm in business, by the way, mm-hmm. because people they let that small problem turn into a big problem. The easy example I can give you: you have a puppy, 8 weeks, 10 weeks old. It's very mouthy. It's mouthing you on the arm. It's so cute. It jumps up all over you. It's so cute because it's an 8 week old puppy. But they don't solve those problems. The next thing you know, the dog's a year and a half. Now it's mouthy. Now it's mouthy behavior. It's starting to turn into, like, not aggressive biting, but it's starting to leave marks on the skin. And that jumping behavior that was never solved, it's knocking people over. So it's true. They don't actually call the dog trainer until the problem gets worse. They don't call the dog trainer until actually something happens that knocks somebody over, and now they're, they potentially have a dog that is considered dangerous, even though it might not be. So that's what a lot of the book covers. The book does cover these basic problems, and I really try to stress to people, you got to solve these problems as you see them. It's like, you can't let that sound in your car go too long, because if you hear that noise clicking in your engine, when you first hear it, it's only a $200 fix. But if you let it go for a couple of years, now it's a $3,000 fix.
You talk about, after we've got this game plan, a lot of times you want people to start with the 7 common commands, and these are your sit and stay and that kind of thing. Why is it important for pretty much any dog to have these 7 common commands in the works?
I kind of coined that phrase years ago, because what I did was I basically thought about what are the most common commands that we ask our dog to do every single day. And I basically rated it down to 7. I narrowed it down to these 7 commands: sit, stay, down, come, off, heel, and no. And the rest, anything else, it's either tricks, and I always say tricks are for kids, or it's commands that actually sound it actually have the same meaning, like stay and wait. It's technically the same command. So I say, you know what? We're going to get rid of one of those. Same with no and leave it. A lot of people teach their dog these 2 commands. I'm like, no, listen, less is more in the dog training world. You want these 7 commands because it's basically the ABCs and 1-2-3s of dog training. It's like grades kindergarten through 12 for your dog. And once dogs have basic obedience, you can teach them anything at that point.
And one point you make in giving these commands is that ultimately they are supposed to be commands, not polite requests or questions.
Exactly. Exactly. Listen, we're parents to our dogs, and just like parents to kids, you're not asking your kid to do the homework. It is mandatory. When you have a kid, you must do your homework, you must do your chores, you must go to school. You must stay out of trouble. These are not requests. There is no negotiating these things. So whenever we tell our dogs to do a command, we are going to tell them to do the command. We're not asking them. And again, you know, you have to have, I always say it's the mafia voice. You don't want to yell at your dog. You don't want to yell at your dog, okay, because that's what shuts them down. How does the mafia talk to somebody there, you know, they're trying to, in a movie, we see they have this very convincing way of talking. And that's what I always say to keep in mind. I said, you don't want to use the volume of your voice. You want to use the conviction of your voice.
We're talking to Brandon McMillan. His new book is Lucky Dog Lessons. And it isn't just training and the firm voice. You talk a lot about quality time with your dog, fun time with your dog. You are in charge. You're their parent. But you also want a friendly relationship. What are things that people should be doing right up front with their dog?
Well, of course. I mean, the basic necessities of your dog does form the relationship. So just walking your dog, spending a lot of time with your dog, playing with your dog, whether it's toys or... a lot of dogs, they love, you know, chasing and fetch and stuff like that. So these are the basic necessities that a dog needs. And that, you know, it kills two birds with one stone. You give the dog what it needs and you form a relationship. Because the reality is the best way to train a dog and the way the dog is going to learn the most efficiently is with someone it trusts. If dogs don't trust you, if they're intimidated by you or scared of you, they're not going to learn efficiently. The best teachers in school that I learned from, I liked them a lot. I liked them. I trusted them. They talked to me in a way that I wanted to learn more, you know, and that was a relationship because the teacher took the time to form the relationship with the students. And it's so vital to training any dog, whether you're a dog trainer or just your regular dog owner. Forming that relationship with a dog is so vital because you'll see it's all about efficiency when you train. Now, if you're just trying to intimidate the dog, you know, you will do this. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. The dog, you're not forming that relationship. It's all about forming the trust, and that way the dog is like, okay, yesterday was fun. What are we going to do today?
And I want to talk about rescue dogs in particular. I know that's a particular interest of yours, and you think with the right training, there is a potential happy ending for all rescue dogs. Can you talk to maybe people out there who have just adopted a rescue dog or are about to, some advice for them?
Well, when I was in my early 20s, I started reading about the statistics about how many dogs are euthanized in America alone just because they can't find homes. And the number hovers around 1.5 million, give or take. And that's an epidemic. And so that's where I really started pounding the pavement to see what I can do. And there's been a big stigma on shelter dogs now since probably the 1950s, who knows, probably before that. And the stigma was always the same. Oh, they were turned into the shelter for a reason. Oh, they're damaged goods. And I have found time and again that shelter dogs are just as trainable, if not more trainable, than breeder bought. We have to make slight adjustments because of their history. And again, you can't fault them because they had a bad first chance. It's our goal to give them a good second chance.
Right. So what kind of things can we do when we bring home that rescue dog to give them that second chance and succeed for the pet owner and the dog itself?
Start forming that relationship right away. Teach them right away that you're not the bad guy. Most likely, a lot of shelter dogs I find, because of their history, they don't trust humans. So your first goal is to form that trust, form that bond. And like I was saying a few minutes ago, once you form that trust, once that bond is solidified, it's amazing how efficiently you can train the dog. The dog wants to learn, as opposed to if you don't form that trust first, then, again, the dog is still very reluctant to learn because it doesn't know if you're the good guy or the bad guy. So always, like I said, and this is exactly what I cover in the book, we talk about, you know, not only breed, we talk about history. And that history is vital. If you can find out what happened to the dog, even better, because now you can form the game plan. And like I said a few minutes ago, it's all about forming the game plan. If you know exactly what happened with that dog, now we can efficiently train the dog because now we have a game plan ahead. We're not going to train this way because the dog was abused. We're not going to try to use a lot of force in the training because that dog was forced to do too much in the past. So we almost go polar opposite of what the dog knows.
You mentioned that stigma, almost bias against sheltered dogs in the past. Do you you talk to a lot of people in the dog world, obviously. Do you see that changing? Are we opening our hearts and minds to bringing these shelter dogs home more than we used to?
Yeah, we are. I see a huge change, but the only issue is I don't see a change in the numbers. The number still hovers around, around 1.5 mil. That number really hasn't changed too much over the years. But yeah, the stigma against shelter dogs, people are opening up. But obviously the numbers don't lie. The numbers really have not changed. And that's the reality. So it makes you wonder, where we're going wrong. When people understand the numbers, when people understand the actual statistics, where it's about 1.5 million dogs are euthanized in America alone because they can't find homes, I challenge people. I say, watch this. Go down to a shelter. Go spend some time with those dogs. You're going to see they're no different than a breeder-bought dog. In many cases, they're a lot better because, again, what I notice time and again is you have these, you have a lot of these shelter dogs, whether they were strays or whether they were just in a backyard and very neglected. They're so appreciative when they get rescued because they know the difference between the good guy and the bad guy.
We'll leave it there, Brandon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Brandon McMillan is an animal trainer, star of the TV show Lucky Dog. His new book is Lucky Dog Lessons: Train Your Dog in 7 Days.